Your name?
Lisa Dodson.
Lisa Dodson, you've recently written a new book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. And you talk about acts of economic disobedience and stories that are not being told in our mainstream media. Talk about this really groundbreaking book.
Well, the Moral Underground for me is a response. It's really a response that I found all around the country, and it was a response to conditions in which people who are working hard, doing the jobs of the nation, are simply not earning enough so that they can take care of themselves and their families. And what I found was that there are middle-income people around the country who work with them every day, so in the workplace or working with kids in schools as teachers, school administrators, and also in healthcare. What I found was that there were these middle-income people, people who themselves are earning a living, a sustainable income, but they would find these moments when they would recognize how poverty wages make it impossible for these families to get by, or make families so unstable that children are having a really hard time in school, or families are coming to the health center or the hospital with really complicated issues and they can't pay even the copay. And what I found was that these middle-income people in these different, well, I see them as almost socioeconomic intersections or class intersections, that they would sometimes break rules. They would ignore rules or actually break rules in order to in a sense, protect or take the side of these low-income working families. And that's really what I call economic disobedience.
Give some of the examples from a doctor who writes a second prescription for a second child that doesn't exist so the mother can also get medicine, to folks who are stacking food all day long but can't end up buying the food that they stack. Talk about some of the examples of Americans subverting these rules.
Well, the first one you mentioned, the doctors who this came up a number of times, and that was doctors who maybe pediatricians or maybe family doctors, and they're seeing a family, and the family only has health insurance for the child, which is not uncommon, and so the doctor's standing there, and she looks at the mom, and she can see it's just obvious that not only the child has strep and is running a high fever, but the mom is sick too, and the rule would be that she would ignore that she would treat the child. But what I found is that it is very common for physicians and nurse practitioners and people in healthcare to actually make the decision. Well, I'll write a second script for this family. I'll say there are two children in the family, and then two people will leave my office who are going to actually get well, and. You know, the issue here, again and again I heard, was that breaking rules is wrong, but there are much bigger wrongs. And in the situation of a manager working in a grocery store, working with people who are all week long doing their job, they're handling food, they're stacking shelves, and at the end of the week he's handing out a paycheck, which he knows is less then these workers can possibly feed their families. They literally don't have access to the food they've been handling all week. And so I met a number of people who work in the food industry who have found ways to pack up bags and at the end of the week pass that food along, thinking that, in fact, the food company, you know, can really make do with some of this food being siphoned off. And again, you know, when I interviewed people who took these sort of acts, the economic disobedience, they absolutely said that they believed in rules, they believe in laws, but they feel that sometimes there's a situation in which it's a greater wrong to ignore a hungry person or ignore a sick mom than break the rule.
Lisa Dodson, in writing The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy, how did you go about doing the research for the book?
Well, originally I was really following the thread of previous research I'd done, and I wanted to find out how low-income parents, largely moms, were managing to take care of their kids and keep them safe while doing the low-wage jobs that they tend to have, jobs in the service sector, retail, care work jobs. So I started out really focusing on them and collecting hundreds of stories, and I decided that it would be really helpful to also talk with people in the middle class who have that kind of direct day-to-day contact with low-income families, low-income workers, or children. And so I was actually interviewing one man. His name in the book is Jonathan. And I was asking him about the low-wage workers that he supervises. And I was asking him the usual questions, you know, what kind of problems do they have? How does he deal with them? Is there high absenteeism, which I'd heard about, tardiness, other issues like that? And he realized that we were at the end of the interview, and he stopped me, and he said to me, "Aren't you going to ask me what this does to me too?" And it was really a wonderful moment for me in doing this research, because he drew my attention in a sharp way to this whole other account of what it's like in a country when millions and millions of our people just can't get by working as hard as they can, that it really leaks into all of our big social institutions, our schools, our workplaces, and the people there are affected as well. And so that's when I really started asking these questions. So how does it affect you to be a nurse or to be a manager or to be a teacher in a school? How does it affect you when you see this every day?
And this book took some 7 years of research, as did your previous one, Don't Call Us Out of Name, which dealt with quote-unquote welfare reform under Clinton. You mentioned, we spoke yesterday, that today people are so busy that, I mean, you were talking with people receiving welfare, I guess, in the 90s, mm-hmm. and people were busy then. But people today are even busier, even harder hit. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, just as a researcher, the kind of work I do is I call it kitchen table research. I try to spend a lot of time with people, you know, listening to their accounts and even accompanying them along the pathway of their daily lives. And back in the 90s, it was very hard. People's lives were very complicated. Most of the people I interviewed actually were already entering the labor market. But the situation now I found is that people are working two jobs, or they're working a job in the formal economy and also an informal economy, because they simply can't get by with just one job. And they're spending all the time they possibly can taking care of their families. And I literally found it much harder to spend time for people to find time in their own lives to actually just sit down and talk, have a conversation, reflect on these issues. You know, I think it's one of the big problems we have right now with, I'm talking about 30 to 40% of our working families right now. They are so busy, it's very hard for them to take their eye off the next thing they have to do and the next issue crisis they have to deal with. So I saw a real difference over the past 15 years.
And it takes you a while to feel comfortable to write about someone. How long do you spend with people, and which cities did you, and where did you visit to do your research?
I was in Denver and Milwaukee and in Boston, New York City, and New Haven, and then in some smaller towns in the New England area, as well as in the Midwest, and then also some rural areas in New England and Maine and Massachusetts. You know, if people have the time, or if they'll allow me to come back, they'll allow me to continue to get in touch with them. And a lot of times people want to, and then they just don't show up, or something comes up, or sometimes their phone number is no longer working. A lot of instability and change in people's lives. But I really, if I can, I like to spend time with people. I like to visit with them several times. And I also like to share with them what I'm writing up about them. I like to share the transcripts so that they have a chance to really reflect on it. And in some cases, particularly those that were involved in these acts of economic disobedience, I have to say more of them did not make it in the book than in fact are in the book, because people were worried And they weren't so much worried about being caught, because I'm very, very careful about names and any kind of identifier. But what they were worried about was having the strategies that they're using to make a little bit of difference, having those exposed. So there were a number of times when I would get these accounts and people would look them over, and then we would decide that they couldn't go into the book.
You mentioned last night at your talk at Busboys and Poets that no matter where you are, when you talk with people, they talk about those who they're most concerned about, who they love. And you presented before Congress, before conferences. It doesn't seem like love would be something that makes it into those prestigious places, but maybe it should be.
Well, I really think that it's the issue, you know, that this issue of caring for other people, which turns out, it shouldn't surprise us. If you sit and talk with almost anybody for any length of time, that's ultimately what they'll be telling you about. They'll be telling you about their relationships and the people they care for. And I see that as the issue that was by far the most of greatest concern to everybody, to low-income working parents, but also to middle-income people, too, who could imagine or said that they didn't want to imagine what it would be like to try to take care of children or an elderly parent or someone who's disabled in their family, making as little as these other people working poor families are making. You know, I really see it as a kind of rallying point, and I think that we ought to bring it up in public forums. I think we ought to remind people that what we're dealing with and care about most is exactly the same, you know, for that 30-40% of our low-wage families in this country, and they just do not have the kind of basic income or flexibility to be able to take care of the people they love. And I think that this is really a shared issue, and it's a basis for some alliances. I see it that way.
What needs to happen to address this problem?
Well, you know, I think that I'd like everybody in on the conversation. You know, I went out and did this research, and I really think I kind of rediscovered, in a sense, that part of the American character that believes that we should have fairness and we should treat our people decently and we should take care of our children. So I guess for me, the next step is more of every opportunity where we can cross the divides, cross the economic class and different communities and different professions. I don't know why teachers and managers and healthcare providers, they need to be talking. They're dealing with the same issues. So for me, I think the most important thing is turning these kind of individual acts of economic disobedience into something that is above the ground and is more collective, that people are working together more.
Lisa Dodson, last night in your talk you mentioned how there are teachers who don't know what their job is right now because kids are coming to school tired, hungry, maybe nervous. You mentioned the situation of a girl, Flora, who, and you could talk about her family situation where, childcare is so expensive that the mother has to figure out a different place for her to go each day, but Thursdays there's nothing, so maybe she's nervous on Thursdays. In D.C., Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee has been very clear that saying poverty has nothing to do with education. They're separate issues. But your research seems to indicate something different.
Yeah, I think that it's actually very simple if you talk with families. It's very simple to see that when you're making decisions about how to use a very, very small income and you have to decide about rent and food and heat and basic utilities, one of the expenses that people find, one of the expenses that they simply don't have any money for and have to come up with themselves is childcare. And in low-income families, you know, I would argue it is endemic in this country that there are children all over in rural and urban America, everywhere, who simply have no care, no adults who are watching over them at sometimes routinely every week. And this issue has a tremendous impact on their lives, on the stability, their routines, their ability to get their homework done, and also just on their sense of safety in this world. You know, it's a world in which we apparently think that the children of America, our children, can go without care, or if we come across situations where kids are left alone will blame their parents, even though their parents are away at work, but don't earn enough to buy care. So I see poverty as having a tremendous impact on the ability of families to take care of their kids and make sure that they're able to be school prepared and to focus on education at all.
Can you talk about the situation with Flora and her family?
Yeah, Flora is a 9-year-old girl. When I talked to her mom, Emily, several times, and Flora had a little brother. He was 5 at the time. And every day of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, all those four days of the week, and Friday, her mom gets out of work early and can pick her up. But the other 4 days of the week, she is a different child care arrangement, all of which depend basically on voluntary situations. A neighbor walks them to a after-school program one day. They take the regular public bus to the grandmother's house on another day. And on Thursdays, Emily is found no way. These kids have no child care at all in the afternoon. And so they hang around in the playground. They try to hang inside the school as long as they can, but the school gets locked down at a certain point. And Flora is at 9. She carries 2 keys around her neck because she goes either to her grandmother's house or when she has to get home alone. She deals every single day with getting ready for this part of the day when she has to take over care for her little brother and really sort out a situation that is just way beyond what any 9-year-old should have to do. And I can tell you there's no question this has a big impact on every day in Flora's life when she's in school, getting ready for that end of the day when she has to really give up being a child because there's no one else there to be the adult for her.
And Lisa Dodson, if the state is to intervene, it's often in the form of Child Protective Services stepping in to say that the parent is at fault. But it really seems like there's not much more that Emily could possibly do on behalf of her children.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I talked to Emily at some length. One of the things she said to me early in our interviews was she said to me, if you can come up with a better plan, just tell me, because this is the best I've been able to do. And I presented in great detail every day of the week of Emily's life to in several conferences, you know, and she actually, there's maybe 7 different people that she's relying on each week that she has tried to get commitments from. I simply see nothing else that she could do, and most of the people, whenever I presented her case, that's really been the reaction. But the reason why Emily doesn't speak up about this in any kind of public way, and I can tell you there are millions of Emily's, you know, and Emily's and fathers of children like Flora and Teddy, the reason they don't speak up, and the reason, in fact, to some degree, they collude with hiding what's going on with low-income children is that if a spotlight was put on Emily, it would be to say that she was a negligent mother. She would be accused of not providing for her children properly. And so of course, people stay quiet. The response isn't, well, we need to open a daycare center, a child care after-school program in this school. We must do that. That's not the response. The response is somehow Emily is at fault. So I think that that's part of the reason that this issue is so hidden.
Lisa Dodson, you pointed out that this is a lack of security, that this is a lack of national security if kids are not secure.
Yeah, to me, I think that the issue of national security has to be stretched quite a bit, and we have to think about what we hold most dear. And I think that this is a profoundly insecure way for children to be leading their lives and for families to be trying to function and do all that they're trying to do. So, yeah, I consider this a major issue of safety and of national security.
In your previous book, you looked at welfare reform and personal responsibility, and you point out we basically have ended welfare. You can be on it for 2 years, you know, the theme being, you know, get a job, any job. But left out of the equation is the impact on children or maybe an elderly parent.
Yeah, that's, I think that as we began to really turn away from the kind of social policies of investing in low-income families, investing in their education, and investing in the families so that someone could stay home with children, we moved much more towards the idea that the labor market would resolve all of this. And if people would just get jobs and have a proper work ethic, then all of this would be resolved. But what didn't go with that policy was an insurance that they would earn wages that made it possible for them to cover all the issues that they no longer could attend to themselves. And a big one is this issue of family care. And I just constantly hear this when I talk to low-income mothers and fathers, first and foremost about their children, but also about their parents or someone in the family who's ill or someone who's elderly. They simply can't be there and act in ways which they say are the greatest personal responsibility issues in their lives, is taking care of the people who they love and who depend upon them.
I knew I loved the title of your book, and I couldn't quite figure out why until this morning. It's the adjectives. You could have said, you know, the title could be The Underground, How Americans Subvert an Economy, but you wrote The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Why'd you use those choice of adjectives?
Well, I found that that's what everyone was saying to me. You know, I really took my title from hundreds of people who, in using different words and very different diverse people, who said to me that they had to call upon their own kind of moral code. Some people said it was because they were Christians. Some people said it was because they came from hardworking second-generation immigrant families. Some because they said they understood how hard single mothers have it. People called upon different of their own personal experiences and families. They called upon their own moral code to, in a sense, these acts of economic disobedience. They were subverting an economy which they just think is profoundly unfair. And they really saw this as a moral choice. And it was shared among lots of different people. So I began to see it as, rather than just these individual acts, as a kind of moral underground.
In speaking with the families who you spent time with, you mentioned that when you sit down with colleagues, you're oftentimes only ones who isn't depressed. And actually, the only person I heard say that, and it recently passed away, was Howard Zinn.
He was my professor.
He was your professor?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was an undergrad many, many, many years ago, Howard was my professor. Yeah, I was studying political science, and he was my professor.
And explain that when you're sitting down with colleagues, you're sensing, even though things are tough, this other kind of pulse that's going through.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, if you're as lucky as I am and you get to actually spend time with regular people, that's how most people, they refer to themselves. They said, I'm just a regular person. If you get to spend time and really listen to how they're looking at the world, what they're struggling with, and what they say matters most in this society, you walk away, not always by any means, but many times you walk away with this deep sense of the decency of so many of ordinary American people, and even their courage, you know, to take a stand and to really extend themselves for others who they see as more vulnerable than they are. So I often walk away feeling really a sense of optimism. I guess the issue that always comes up, of course, and always gets raised is, how do we pull all this together? You know, how do we make this public? Because I think that this is really, you know, it reflects our history in many ways. I think of it as our best American history, and it's still alive and out there, but it is not, it hasn't yet come into the public spotlight.
Lastly, Lisa Dodson, what surprised you in writing this book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy?
You know, I guess I was honestly surprised at, I wasn't so much surprised at people in healthcare who were really willing to reach out. We've seen a lot about how incoherent the healthcare system is. I was surprised at what some of the teachers were willing to do. You know, I met a teacher who, you know, there's the residential requirement. So if a child has to move, they lose access to a school. And I met teachers who were willing to kind of fudge the paperwork and claim the child was still in the local area so they could stay in school. I met one teacher, though, who had offered the children her own address, and she actually apparently had 12 children from the school living with her. You know, that was a surprise, that really sticking her neck out. And other people had to have known that she was doing it, too, and they seemed to be sort of letting it under the radar. But I have to say I was most surprised talking to people who were in business, people who were managers in businesses, big businesses, small businesses, who really saw part of their work as being providing jobs. I mean, we hear nothing but bottom line in most economic conversation now. But there are a lot of people out there who are in business and or who are managers in large businesses, and they see the value of good jobs. And they were terribly disheartened that the jobs that, that the people were filling are the people they were supervising were not providing them with anywhere near a sustainable income. And so I think I was most surprised. I mean, Jonathan really stopped me. You know, he said, this touches us too. This changes our lives too. He talked about seeing himself as a fair man. That was part of his sense of himself. He's supervised people. He supervised them fairly. He saw jobs as a wonderful attribute for his community. And he had stopped seeing himself as a fair man. And he wanted me to remember that, you know, there's a lot of people out there you might not assume, in fact, care a lot about fairness.
There's one other point I wanted you to touch on, which is the teacher who put together a special education class, even though the kids didn't fit that description as we know it. But she said, "What if kids that are low income are going to be targeted with special injustices, then they deserve special treatment?"
Yeah, it was actually a principal of a school, and she had worked very hard to get more special education into her school, because when you get special education teachers, they give more one-on-one help, and they're smaller groups. And I was asking her about, you know, the rates of kids in her school that were seen as having special needs, and she explained to me that, you know, in a situation when children are having to be hypervigilant, Flora is a good example, having to watch out for their younger siblings, having to worry about who's going to be there when they get home at the end of the day or be home alone. She considered that to be what society had created as especially hard conditions for kids, unfair conditions for kids. And so if she could arrange for these kids to get some one-on-one help, some special needs support to help them cope with, to help them be educated, but also to help them cope with the really special difficulty of their situation. She saw that as a perfect use of special education.
Last night, I think you described yourself as a public sociologist. What does that mean?
Well, to me, what it means is, I mean, it's a term a lot of us use who really want the work we do and the research that we do to be very made available to the public, to have it be immediately useful, either in a local community or in public policy that's being formed. I also think of it as public in both ways, in my case. Absolutely, I want the work that I do to be useful and to be made available as we're trying to formulate better services and systems for low-income people. But I also see myself as a public sociologist in that I seek the views of that part of the public that often get ignored. I often think of it as I'm looking for the history makers who are never heard from. And so I see myself as a public sociologist in terms of where I do my research and also where I try to bring my research.
I definitely hear some Howards in there, the history makers who I've never heard from. Thanks so much for your time.